Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at DR5, DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.DR5.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org, and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with the legendary Ron Mowry. Ron's going to join us today to talk about photographic engineering, emulsions, a lot of cool stuff that he's up to, and we always love to have Ron join us on the program. Of course, he's been with us many times before. So without further ado, the legendary Ron Mowry. Ron, how you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing just fine, Scott. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us again here, buddy, on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you back on the program. We always love to have you with us, and we're really appreciative that you're going to join us today and talk about some really cool stuff that you've been up to. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you too, Scott. And I'd also like to thank all those people who have sent me some very nice notes about the previous interviews. If you want to hear anything in particular, send me a note. I'm on APUG or PhotoNet. Just send a note.
There you go. We always love to have you in the program. I think people really, really enjoy listening to what you have to say. So again, it's great to have you here. And I think today's going to be extra cool because we're going to start off here talking about the workshop that you guys just completed at the George Eastman House that you and Mark Osterman did in regards to silver gelatin emulsions. I think this was a pretty cool event.
Well, thanks, Scott, for bringing that up. We had a terrific workshop in Rochester. We had 6 students and came to the course, and we had a marvelous time. Mark kicked it off with a terrific presentation and a textbook on the history of silver gelatin that he put together for the course. We had engineers from NASA, photo students, bachelors of fine art. We had a student from Germany. We had people from all over that attended the course. As fallout, we have new people now making emulsions. They've made some very nice photos and have posted them on the internet. Things just went swimmingly. What we did basically was, over the 3 days, we made a basic azo-type emulsion in grade 2, and then we turned that into grade 3 and 4 by chemical manipulation, and they coated all 3 grades side by side on a variety of different paper stocks, and then they printed their negatives, or if they didn't have any, they printed our stock negatives, on these 3 different grade of papers to prove to themselves that they'd made 3 different contrast grades, and they were just elated. So we had a great time, and in addition to that, a couple of the engineers from Kodak that joined us for lunch stopped in, joined the class, and answered questions. That was kind of like an added, spice to the mix. The students really enjoyed getting a chance to meet Bob Shanebrook, for example, the author who has just recently published a book on how Kodak makes film. He was there, and he talked to many of the students about some of his projects and what he used to do. So that was basically our workshop. As I say, it went well, and in fact so well that we have tentatively planned one for September. It'll be a reprise of the same course. We're asking for subscriptions in advance to see if it'll go, because George Eastman House is going to have to do a bit of a tap dance to get it in because of their crowded schedule. But those interested can send a note to Mark Osterman or to Stacy Vandenberg at George Eastman House. Their addresses are on the website under the workshop section. So all you have to do is just pre-sign up for the course, and they will ask you for what dates you prefer, because it's kind of a little bit open right now, and they're going to try to squeeze it in September.
I think this opportunity is unique that you'll find nowhere else because of the wealth of knowledge that you have and the instruction that you're going to get basically just hanging out with you alone. But add on the George Eastman House experience that you can get nowhere else. I mean, it's hard to explain what the whole Eastman House experience brings to the whole deal in general.
Well, to give you an idea, several of the students stayed an extra day on their own, and Mark Osterman was kind enough to set up a private viewing of some very rare photographs, including one by Ansel Adams that has rarely ever been shown, and also he showed us two boxes of Lippmann plates, some of them made by Lippmann himself, I understand. And I guess this kind of knocked people's socks off to see the originals. And an Ansel Adams, they couldn't believe it was Ansel Adams, as a matter of fact, because it was a picture of railroad tracks. And it's not his usual subject. It wasn't a landscape. And the only reason they got it immediately, they saw the Ansel Adams signature at the bottom. So they got a real guided tour. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting little side note. They are repairing the pipe organ in George Eastman House. And the gentleman who is doing the work and practicing on it plays on Mondays when George Eastman House is closed. But our course started on Monday, so we got in, of course. When we came back from lunch, he was sitting at the pipe organ practicing right in front of the table that George Eastman used to eat at breakfast time and listen to pipe organ music. So we stood there enthralled listening to beautiful organ music.
Wow. Where are you going to duplicate that at?
Nowhere. It was really something. And, of course, we had a lovely time. Mark's presentation, his textbook, everything went absolutely perfectly from start to finish. So we're hoping for a total reprise of everything in September. And if everything goes well and we build up enough students, we have planned a 3-4-part total course system that will start out with the AZO contract grade paper, move into a Kodachrome emulsion, and then go to film emulsions. So we'll have a 3-step system, and we will probably also include coding, photographic engineering, and some things like that. So we may have up to 4 different workshops in this series, each one running 3-4 days.
Wow, I would love to go to the one about photographic engineering. I bet you that's going to be fun.
Well, actually, what happened was, in the current one, somebody asked a question about it. Why are films the way they are? Why this? Why that? And I looked at the clock, and I said, well, we got to be out of here by 3:30. I can do a quickie in about 10 minutes, maybe 15, and Stacy and Mark were sitting in the back, and they just nodded kind of, yeah, and waved, go ahead. So I was given about 15 minutes to do some doodling on the blackboard and show them how and why a photographic system existed. It was a little overview, but I think they really enjoyed it, and I think that was an added attraction for doing something like this.
Is there anywhere or any place that you can actually take photographic engineering, or is this completely a dead art now? If they don't learn it from someone like you, you're never going to get it.
Well, they used to have something like it at RIT. They probably have it to some extent, but it's more oriented towards digital systems.
That's not photographic. That's like making a toaster, right? Okay, I'm going to go to school and I'll learn how to make a chip that represents photographic process, but it's not real. It's like a toaster school.
I love your analogy.
Well, I mean, really, come on, that's not photographic engineering. Photographic engineering is, like you said, this is how to capture light in an analog fashion.
Well, the only real similarity between digital and analog is the fact that in analog we have a D log E, density versus log exposure curve, and in digital they develop what's called a V log E curve, voltage, the voltage potential across the sensor. So they have a V log E curve, and we have a D log E curve. That's about it.
Well, a Phobion digital chip is the closest thing you're going to get to anything that's real, because each sensor location captures red, blue, green.
Well, in analog, each sensor location captures red, blue, green. But in the digital system, the red, green, and blue are side by side. And so this creates an aliasing effect, or a jagged effect, a loss of exposure as a function of the size of the sensor. In a 35 millimeter film or sensor, an object can be as small as 1 to 10 microns, like a telephone wire in a scene. If the telephone wire were red, the analog system would catch it, but the digital system would see it as a red dotted line because of the sensor.
Right. It's the bear pattern.
But in any event, we've got a series of workshops planned. I attended one of Mark's workshops, one on dry collodion printing out paper. Ran into one of my old students there, and we had a lovely reunion and talked to a lot of the students. They were turning out some beautiful collodion POP prints, and I spent a couple hours with them. So it was pretty much a reprise in a different medium than my course. And I'm looking forward to working with Mark on a few other projects in the coming few months.
What do you figure, Ron, is the biggest topic or the biggest request that you've heard for what people want to learn? Is it really that they want to make their own paper because there's a missing gap in what's available now? Is it that people really want to make their own film? What do you think people want to do when it comes to making emulsions and being this alchemist and doing all this secret cool stuff in the darkroom?
Well, that's an interesting question. You see, Scott, with the rapidity with which analog sales are falling off, most of the people I talk to are unsure which direction to jump. And so they're more interested in me trying to guesstimate what is going to happen next. And I'm no better than the next guy, really, at guesstimating what's going to happen. One of the big things that I've been asked lately over and over again, what is the earthquake and the nuclear radiation going to do to Fuji?
Yeah, that's a great topic that you bring that up. I mean, it's not great what happened, and we're really bummed out for what happened to Japan and the Japanese people. And I think this nuclear thing is turning into a nightmare for those people, and they don't even have a grip, I think, of how bad it is, really. But that all aside, how does this radiation spill and all these things that are going into the atmosphere around Japan, how does this affect film? This is a great topic, this whole thing about radiation, because even right now in Rochester or San Francisco or anywhere in the U.S. or anywhere in the world, there's ions being bombarded from the sun. So there's always this background radiation issue. But now you throw this on top of what's going on in Japan. How does that affect the whole analog photography industry itself, especially Japan?
Okay, yeah. First off, I want to say up front, my wife and I have been very concerned because, as some people know, I lived in Japan and on some of the islands for a year and a half. And have a lot of friends there, especially at Chiba University, which is at the north edge of Tokyo Bay. And so they are the closest spot in Tokyo to the accident. And they are the largest photo school, as far as I know, in Japan. So my heart goes out to Professor Kubo and his wife, who teach there. Well, he's retired now, but she's still teaching. And Fuji, the plant in Ashigara, I believe, not very far, probably 20 to 30 miles due west of Tokyo. I have to distinguish in radiation. The bombardment we get from outer space is particles coming down to the Earth in the form of cosmic radiation. The stuff that's coming out of the nuclear plant is a combination of both radiation and radioactive elements, which get into the environment or can drift as dust. So they're a lot different. You can't pick up a radiation particle on your foot and track it into a building, but you can pick up radioactive dust and track it into the building. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And that is the problem that Kodak faced with the bombs going off in Nevada back in the 40s. Kodak had to install protective devices for not only that, but for the explosions and tests in the Pacific. They have foot baths, they have air knives when you go in and out of buildings, all kinds of equipment to prevent the entry of radioactive elements or dust on the ground. I have no idea what Fuji has. But I could say two things. First, the actual earthquake itself will shut down production of film because of the shaking of the building. The equipment will just be rattled so badly that the production is ruined. Then, after that, they have to check the alignment of the machine to make sure that nothing got knocked out of alignment. If it is, it has to be repaired. If it isn't, they can start right back up again. But if they do, well, let's just imagine that there's radioactive iodine in the water, which we've already been told there is. Radioactive iodine in the water can affect emulsions. And so they have to install some sort of method to guard against that radioactivity getting into the emulsion, or it will begin to show up as tiny black dots in the film or paper given enough time. Now, radioactive iodine is not the worst actor. It's got a half-life of about 8 days. So it's going to decay over a period of months down to zero. But there are some other things that are coming off of there that are going to be fairly long-lived and can fog photomaterials. I can't predict what's going to happen. People keep asking me over and over again. I get emails. I get private messages. I don't know. Be prepared, if you wish, for a slight shortage of Fuji products. But I can't say that's going to be true or false. I'm just saying, if you're concerned, be prepared. We have already seen shortages of automobile parts and things like that, even paint for cars, for almost all manufacturers. So, figure this might happen for Fuji products as well.
Well, I mean, that's to be expected, I guess. Look at Fuji's hot new digital rangefinder camera, right, with the APS-C sensor that everybody was all up in arms over. You can't get them. They've halted production and things are on hold. So I think they're trying to regroup. Plus, people don't understand that even with photographic emulsions, Fuji doesn't make all these chemicals. They have to buy stuff as well, just like Kodak. And if there's things that are being affected from outside of their control, then that throws another wrench into the gear.
Yes, that's exactly right, Scott. And I don't know how far reaching that's going to be because that whole area, a large crescent around Tokyo Bay, is probably one of the most concentrated industrial chemical areas in the entire world. I've driven through it. I've flown over it. I've lived on the outskirts of it. And it is a very, very large concentration of industry that's been affected. What's going to happen if Fuji needs a given sensitizing dye and the dye ends up being radioactive? All I can say is that I wish the best for all of the people there. And I was just shocked seeing the aftershock announced on TV. That was another blow to the poor, suffering people there.
Yeah, it's a bummer, but it's the same thing can happen in the Midwest. I mean, the biggest fault in the United States is in the middle of the country. And look at the West Coast, and I mean, people just forget about things until something bad happens. So like you said, it's a terrible situation, but we wish everybody the best and our friends at Fuji, so.
Yes, and I hope that they do well. But that was just an example of one of the many, many questions that I get. As far as what else I'm doing, well, a lot of people know about it, doing VAG experiments. That is measuring the exact electropotential of my emulsions to get a better feel for what I'm making and how I'm controlling it.
So what does that consist of? What does that mean?
You have to set up a pair of electrodes in the emulsion as you're making it, the voltmeter connected to that, a very sensitive one, and you measure the millivolt change, and that can tell you whether you're making cubes, octahedra, and how uniform it is.
Really?
You control it at exactly a given point, then you can make sure you're making uniform octahedra of 1 micron, for example. If it drifts, you're not making them anymore. You're making cubes and so forth.
And how do you control that?
You control it by balancing the salt and silver flows. So actually, you always keep the silver flow constant and vary the salt flow to keep VAG constant.
Wow. I guess it's sort of like measuring specific gravity, or do you do that as well?
I don't measure specific gravity. The VAG is a much more sensitive measure. So I'm into that. I've made a couple of dual-run emulsions where I pump in salt and silver simultaneously to control the VAG. In fact, I doodled out some figures here using a little hand calculator and figured that it would take me something like 1 hour to reach a given VAG with a given flow rate. And over that 1 hour period, I was accurate to within a half a minute, I believe it was. So everything's working so far.
Wow, that's cool. That means you're controlling your process and your quality control is even tighter than ever.
Yeah, now the problem I've got, and I'm right in the middle of this, is that the emulsion was no good for two reasons. First one was that I couldn't mix it fast enough. And secondly, I didn't have the appropriate baffling. So even if I had mixed it with the right rotational speed, I couldn't create the right turbulence in the kettle to cause mixing to occur efficiently. You have to create turbulence and you have to create a huge flow rate.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, how would you even mix this? What do you use, a mixer? Like you're baking a cake? Or you got some big, huge monster industrial turbine? I mean, how does that even work?
Okay, it's basically a turbine. The one for my scale of emulsions would be around 2 to 3 inches across, and it would fit into a 1-liter beaker, and it would run at around 1,500 to 3,000 RPM.
Wow, that's some serious mixing.
It sure is. In fact, you decorate the walls rather quickly.
I mean, think about it. You have a small beaker. Let's say the beaker is 6 inches in diameter. That's a common beaker, I guess. For what are you mixing? A liter at a time, maybe?
A liter, yeah.
Okay, so you have a liter beaker, and you got this little thing that's 2 inches diameter. It's spinning 3,000 RPM. This must want to take everything and just eject it out of the beaker.
Yeah, that's about what happens. You see, the baffles that I mentioned actually prevent that from happening, because they prevent the vortex that throws it out of the beaker from taking place. And so what you get is kind of like a large set of moving waves on the surface instead of a V-shaped vortex. That's what I'm working on right now in the lab.
So these are little baffles, like pieces of metal that are cut with like little flaps or something, and these go down inside the beaker to keep the vortex from basically ejecting all the liquid out.
That's right. And if worse comes to worse, you put a lid on it. But our first test was in a regular household bucket. A friend of mine who machined it brought it over. We put it on the end of my shop drill and stuck it into the bucket, half filled with water, and decorated ourselves and the wall with water.
So this is something you just can't go and buy off the shelf?
No, they are special made precision instruments. And along with it comes a sheet of paper from my friend who has done all the calculations on the energy levels that are generated at different RPMs.
Wow, so this is made by some other engineer.
Oh yeah, he's just written a textbook on crystallization, and he has his own consultancy too. And we work together on a number of projects. We've been friends for years, and he's part of our lunch group.
Wow. It's amazing. People just think, oh, I can just pour some chemicals together and I can make myself some cool paper. Well, sort of to start evolving that process to be able to get, like you said, smaller and smaller grain or this kind of consistency or repeatability, you need to have all these things.
Yeah, that's the problem. I had one person who asked me to make an emulsion for him, and it took me 3 tries and I made one and it was almost exactly what he wanted. And, you know, I haven't been able to duplicate it in 2 years because of variability. That's why I'm working on this variability problem. Now, on another front, I should add that I am putting all this information into the book because my friend who is really into mixing has pointed out to me that I had not, up to this point, correctly differentiated in enough detail the difference between stirring, mixing, and homogenizing. Stirring, as you know, is just a little mixing bar on the bottom of a beaker. Mixing really implies mixing the whole volume and turning that volume over.
So that would be sort of, let's equate that into a KitchenAid stand mixer like you're going to make a cake.
That's right, but you don't want to beat air into it.
Right. Is that where you get into emulsifying?
Okay, emulsification, that's the high end of a blender which beats things to a pulp. And you don't want to do that because if you beat an emulsion to a pulp, you fog it. So emulsification is the extreme end of the continuous spectrum of stirring, mixing, and emulsification. The emulsification process is used to make photographic dispersions in color films. So Kodak has all three. They have mixers, stirrers, and emulsifiers, and I've used all three. And I guess I'll have, when you get right down to it, all three of them here at home, too. So I'll be able to make whatever end of it I want to. So the book was submitted to five of my peers, and they all wrote copious notes for me, both within the copy of the book they received and on separate sheets. And I am now in the process of trying to integrate that all and add the sections that need more padding out with information. Sensitometry, densitometry, photographic engineering, and mixing, stirring, and homogenizing. So that's where I am right now on that. And since you last talked to me, I made my first color image using the dye bleach process.
Really?
Yeah, I made a magenta single color image. I did about four of them, I believe, and found out that I was having some problems with the chemistry on regular paper. So I had to go to Brita, and I'm still having a little bit of a problem because the dye bleach chemistry is so powerful it can affect the paper adversely. So anyhow, I've made my first color image and am working on perhaps making a bicolor magenta and yellow to demonstrate. So that's where I am right now, Scott.
Pretty busy stuff, Ron. Besides all this fine quality help that you give to people over at APUG, I know you spend a lot of time over there. So it's amazing that you get this stuff done besides pontificating on the web.
Well, I'll have to describe a little bit of what my schedule might look like. I have Word up on my computer with the book, which is called, on my computer, The Survival Guide. It's a survival guide for analog photographers in the digital age. So I call it Survival Guide. And I have my net browser side by side with it. And so when I get tired writing, I just click on the browser and I go right to APUG, which is one of my tabs or my email, and just peruse the latest posts. So about once every 1 to 3 hours, I'll pop in on APUG or PhotoNet or Emulsion 101 or my mail account, and I'll just check and see what's going on. And then I'll go back to writing. And then after I've written to the point where I can't write anymore, I come over, sit down in my easy chair where I am right now, and I'll either read for a little bit or I'll sit here with my notebook writing notes about what I've been doing on the computer. Then I'll think about them, go back to my original documents and say, no, I've got to change that. Or no, I've duplicated this two times in the book. Maybe I should decrease that. So that's how I work, in a kind of like a round robin of several tasks. And in between, yeah, I'm on APUG. So there we are. That's my day.
So Ron, with all the stuff that you're doing and all the time you spend, I mean, what do you really want to do? What's your number one thing that you want to work on here? I mean, you have so much cool stuff going on. It's really amazing. But what's your number one deal? What's your number one priority? What's your mission?
Well, I'll have to interject a funny note to start with. The last 3 days I've spent cleaning glassware, doing dishes, so to speak. The life of an emulsion chemist consists of a lot of time cleaning glassware and stainless steel equipment.
And this is just you're in a sink with an apron on scrubbing.
That's right. You got me. Yep, scrubbing away. I got one of these green scratchy pads and I'm scrubbing emulsion. So that's part of my time. But where do I want to go? My goal is to impart as much analog photography knowledge as possible. The problem is I can't do it. I don't have a reach far enough to do it, nor do I see enough people interested in doing it. My impression is that many people want to leap before they can crawl. They want to fly before they can walk. And they don't have any chemical knowledge or anything. Okay, I can teach them everything they need to know, but they've got to slow down. Quite a few people want to generate images today, and yet they don't realize that they can't do it until 3 days from now. And so I have a limited audience with great desire, but a limited experience in the darkroom, or a limited experience with the materials science involved in doing this. So that's basically the problem. And I've said it before, half in jest, but I mean it in truth. What I need is an apprentice.
Okay, so here's a question. Let's say if you had somebody that wanted to be an apprentice, right? Or you wanted to take on one. How long of a process would it be to do the Vulcan mind melt with Ron to be able to share this knowledge that you have into an apprentice? I mean, what are we talking? A decade? 6 months?
Yeah, probably 6 months of intermittent work. I mean, the students mastered the idea of making azo emulsions in 3 days at three different contrast grades. To get the theory behind it, though, would probably have taken another 2 to 3 days. To do all of the emulsion, probably take all 4 weeks, but to get all of the theory behind it and all of the data is going to take a couple of months. You see what I'm saying?
Well, sure, and that's just for black and white paper. What if somebody wants to know about color dyes in C41, or if they want to know about E6? There's a lot of things that you've worked on over your career that don't have to do with black and white paper.
Yeah, actually, they threw me right into ectacolor paper. Right from day one, I was working on color paper. And black and white was just a serious side issue, so to speak. So I had to learn root hog or die is something that my grandmother used to say. You're going to find out, young man, when you go into industry, it's root hog or die. Have you ever heard that?
Nope.
Do you know what it means?
Nope.
It's referring to a pig has to go out and root in the ground for anything to eat or he's going to starve to death.
Right.
So you got to work hard or you're going to starve.
Oh, there you go.
So that's it, basically. Yeah, root hog or die. And that came from my grandmother when she was in her 70s or 80s. So, yeah, it's going to take people up to 6 months to become good photographic engineers. And the reason I know that is because what they did at Kodak was have us take what we call Ding Dong School. And every afternoon, we'd take 2 hours off, and we'd go into the lab upstairs. It was one floor up from where my office was. And I would have to make coatings, and I would have to start from scratch, pick an emulsion. They would make it for me, but I'd pick an emulsion. I'd make my dispersions. I'd pick the coupler and the solvent, and I'd do all the calculations, and I'd coat it with hardener and surfactant and do hand coatings. Then I'd process it in my own mix of solutions and evaluate it and come up with a written report on it. And if it went far enough, then they'd assign me time on a coating machine. And I'd have to machine coat it and then critique what was different about the machine coating versus the hand coating. And that's the way we worked. So that took about 6 months, and it was just fairly easy to do. I mean, for somebody that knew just enough photographic chemistry to get by. I was an organic chemist. So yeah, I can do it in 6 months.
Do you think that to even get into anything doing with photographic emulsions that somebody should have a very good understanding of organic chemistry before they even start?
No. Some of the best photographic engineers I knew had never taken a course in chemistry as far as I know. One fellow was a materials science engineer. Another one had an MFA. So he knew photography, but he didn't know chemistry. He was a great engineer because he knew photography.
So really, that's the key point. If you know photography, you can start learning this.
Absolutely.
But that's the question. You have to know photography.
Yeah. And you see, in Rochester, there's not many people interested in this. I'd like to say that there are some wonderful people here in Rochester that have given me assistance. And some people who I can totally understand where they're coming from are totally disinterested in any of this type of stuff. They've had a complete career and they just want to walk away from it. But I thank them all. I appreciate it. And I will say right here again, I've said it many times, many of them could do a better job at this than I'm doing. That's a simple fact.
Yeah, but guess what? You're the one that's doing it, though.
Well, okay, sure.
Okay, so you're doing it and they're not. So you're the one that's helping the whole photographic community. And like you said, other people are just like, I'm done.
Yeah, there are a lot of us here, but nobody much teaching anything except myself and Mark. And of course, his wife, France. In other cities, there are many people that teach it, but it's mostly all alternative photography. Cyanotype, POP, albumen, collodion. You can go on and on and on with all the alternative, platinum and palladium and all of these. They even teach straight analog photography courses in printing. But you see, there are a lot of other courses that could be taught, like the theory of the design of a developer and a fixer. Now, there's a course that's never been offered.
Oh, I would love to do that one. And that's the thing with black and white development and fixing. But let's just pick a developer. There's 7,500 ways a Sunday to do it, and maybe there's a better one. Maybe people need to learn on what the difference is in all these different things between different chemicals and why and what. And I think if you have this photographic engineering sort of prerequisite learning type of gig going on, and you would understand why this developer does this to silver halide crystals and how all this stuff interacts, instead of just being dumbfounded and going, "Ooh, I'll pick D76 because that's a nice number. I used to buy gas at Union 76. How cool."
Yeah, well, at Kodak, there were numerous developers and fixes undergoing R&D when they terminated black and white and color process development. I sat down and whipped up Liquidol with Bill Troop. He and I both collaborated on it. And we've come up with a developer that works almost exactly like a Dectol, but has about 3 times the tray life or capacity, one or the other. So there you are. There's a developer that we were able to go into the lab and say, this is what we want. We want to replicate Dectol for a print paper, but we want, 2 to 4 times the lifetime. Well, you can have 3, maybe 4 times the lifetime, or 3 to 4 times the capacity. There you are. We did it. Because there were formulas that I knew of that were sitting on the shelf. A fixer. I came up with a new fixer that will make a bleach fix for color film possible. It also does everything that TF4 does, that is short fix times, even shorter fix times, shorter wash times, so it's better than TF4. The problem is that the ingredients are exotic and it's expensive. So I can come up with a lot of stuff, but is it saleable? Some yes, some no. Is it doable? Yes, and so on and so forth. But the theory behind it might someday lead someone to something that is cheaper, better, and quicker. You see what I'm saying? And that course could be taught.
Yeah, I think that needs to be learned. Maybe I'm just negative Nilly, but if you look at the tracking of color negative film, and what drives this industry is motion picture. And yep, it's losing its hold every day. Digital technologies keep replacing analog capture and motion picture work. At one point, when is Kodak going to say, you know something, we're going to stop the bleeding. Let's just nuke the rest of Kodak Park. What do you do then? I mean, now you're stuck with black and white film.
I got bad news for you. Kodak Park does not exist anymore, officially.
Okay. Well, whatever it is.
Well, it's called Eastman Industrial Park, and the reason for that is that so many other companies are using that land that Kodak is no longer the dominant industrial manufacturer there.
Right. They're probably making cupcakes or something instead of films. See, here's the thing. You can learn how to make black and white film. I'm sure the Chinese or the Eastern Europeans or somebody will continue to make black and white film far after we're dead, many lifetimes over. But color stuff is so complex that once the big giant throws in the towel, you're sort of SOL. That's it. It's over.
Well, you're probably going to get color from Lucky.
Ooh, Lucky does have color. You're right. I've seen it on eBay. I've been wanting to buy some just to see how bad it really is. Or is it Kodak Gold 200 when I'm buying Lucky 200 color?
When you're buying Lucky film, you're probably getting a 1990s formula of Kodacolor Gold. That's a guess on my part.
Ooh, might be tasty, actually.
It might be, yeah. But they had some issues back in the 80s, I know, getting up to speed because of problems with the culture and the chemical availability and things like that in China. They're very industrious and very fine people. And I love Chinese food. But getting to the idea of clean room technology is something that is just now starting to percolate through the Chinese industrial scene. They are probably doing better at it than F-Key or any of the Soviet photo companies. I don't know. But from the looks of it, with the recent advances in technology over there, I would think that they're probably going to be up to about Kodak's capabilities within a few years. The problem is there going to be a market for film then? Because if there isn't, they're not going to make it.
Well, that's it. I mean, they're the first ones that would throw in the towel because they can make some other knockoff. Instead of worrying about making film, they could use the coating technology for I don't even know what.
Yeah, I was thinking of making cookies with a coating machine. That would really work. You could extrude the dough through the slot in the hopper if you made it big enough. The problem is that the chocolate chips would get caught.
Well, the problem is, I think they're probably already using that kind of technology, but they're not doing multi-layer cookies. See, if you could do a multi-layer cookie,
you could put the icing on all at once.
You could.
Sure. And if you put in enough baking soda, you could make them rise up and make them great big things.
There you go. So, Ron, let's talk about where people can go to George Eastman House to chat with people in regards to your next workshops. And also, let's talk about how they can find out about what you're doing. I guess the best place to send them for that is probably APUG. But let's talk about the workshop contact.
Okay. Go onto the internet to geh.org. That will put a banner up at the top. Say, do you want the main George Eastman House website? Click on that. Then on the left-hand panel at the bottom, you will see the word workshops. Click on that. That will take you to a schedule of all workshops, and it will tell you how to register. And it will have Mark Osterman's email address and Stacy Vandenberg's address, and you just simply click on that, and you can send her an email. Or you can call George Eastman House, and you can ask for Mark or Stacy, and you'll get through to them.
Well, the phone works the best, so rattle their cage.
They're taking pre-registration. The date is open. I have personally had 6 inquiries and directed them directly to Mark. One of the people has actually called Mark and talked to him on the phone about the course. So it's proceeding slowly but surely, and once we reach critical mass, they will be able to pick a date, and they have to shoehorn it in because the facilities, even though they're very extensive, are still somewhat limited.
Well, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, so the more you call, the better it is.
Well, if you call with a serious bid to register for the class, then we're one step closer to getting it on the schedule. Remember, their schedule that was made back in November, and they were able to get our course in and 6 students by February. So it worked fine. The problem is that they still don't have a date, and I want to try and get that up there as soon as possible. And next year we plan at least one, if not 2 more. That would be 2012. We plan 2 or more, and one of them may be azo paper again. The other one will probably be level 2 codabromide.
Wow. What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way to get a hold of me is email or PM through PhotoNet or APUG.
There you go. So it's easy to find you. And of course, Ron, I really appreciate you joining us again. We look forward to chatting here in a few weeks with more cool topics. There's about 1,000 different things we're going to be talking about. And it's just great to have you back on the program to give us sort of an update here of what's been going on with the workshops. And we sort of drift off sometimes, but the key point today was this educational opportunity and what you can actually learn from the master. So I think it's fabulous, buddy.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. And I'd also like to thank George Eastman House for this opportunity, too.
Yep, George Eastman House is a fabulous place. I think people should join. If you don't live in Rochester, I think it's like $25 a year or something. And what it does to just the whole world of photography in general, people don't even understand. You really need to look at what they're doing. And if you get a chance to go there, it's unbelievable. You could spend like weeks there.
Oh, yeah. Easy. Well, look, it's been very good talking to you, Scott. And I wish you all the best, too.
Okay, buddy. And I appreciate it. And I look forward to our next chat here coming up very soon. Thank you so much, Ron.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Bye-bye now.
Well, there you go. Ron Mowry, a great guy, an unbelievable source of information for the photographic community, the work he does on APUG, his new book, his DVD set, everything is incredible that this guy touches is fabulous work. We've loved to have Ron on the program, and of course, he's going to be joining us with many more episodes talking about all things traditional photography. The Inside Analog Photo Radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shippard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.